All of season two is Del Big Tree. Part
episode
14.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
It's a new approach.
It's all Del all the time.
14-hour interview cut into 14 pieces.
The extended cut.
He's done. We're trying to be serious here.
I'm sorry.
Remember?
Go, right.
When you open the door for somebody else.
Welcome, everyone, to the Vaccine Conversation with Melissa and Dr. Bob. Today, we continue with a very exciting and intimate, I like that, interview with Del Big Tree. We just finished a really interesting look into his life and what led him here. Like I mentioned on our first podcast, we're going to do things a little differently this season and really get to know some of the people that have made a marker in your life and our lives and this movement. And so we learned a lot about Del. Make sure and check out that first episode. And we today are going to talk about his work and not so much his work of what he's done, but what comes next and what is on the horizon. And the biggest thing I want to make sure we don't cover, because I don't think it's in your questions, is what does he need from us? What does he want the listeners and the public to know and to do, and not just like go to a website and get involved, but like literally, what do you want us to do? Give us a very detailed call to action so that people can be inspired to be a part of your mission and a part of your project and feel themselves getting drawn into a need to participate, because I know this has to go national. This has to go global. How do we do it? How do you help us do it? And what do you need from us?
Yeah, so save that for the end.
Yes.
We'll build to that, and hopefully I'll have an answer by the time we get there.
Don't forget what you were going to say. Yeah.
But also, you know, we're going to do all kinds of topics in season two. You know, just all kinds of more diseases to cover, more vaccines to cover, more, controversial issues, but yeah.
And the media from the 80s and the 90s have some really great articles and some vaccine court cases we're going to dissect. There's a lot going on here.
But I like it. We're really going to try to bring in a number of guests to just get really deep into their lives, what makes them tick, so you guys can understand
how you take your eggs in the morning. Del, how do you take your eggs in the morning?
I'm kind of curious, Del.
Wait, he has to answer the question.
If I have control over it, I'll probably go over easy. But because the kids like scrambled, I'm usually just getting the leftovers from, as Lee's, like getting them ready for school.
I'll do every household with kids is just like that. But see, listeners, this is – you didn't know it. You didn't know it before.
You didn't know that. You didn't know.
And now you do.
That's right.
Now you do. All right. Now let's get serious.
So I'm kind of curious, who would Del Big Tree be today if you didn't hear about the William Thompson thing and you didn't meet Andy Wakefield and you just continued on the doctors for a while? And I don't know, I'm just kind of curious what would you be doing now, and what would be your life like and your passion? And would you be the executive producer of the doctors by now, or I don't know? What do you think?
You know, I suppose that's sort of the track I was on. I was really – the answer I want to say is I don't think that's possible.
Oh, I like that. That's a great answer.
I don't think that's possible that I'm not here. Mm-hmm. It's just – as I said, on the last show, that – there's something really divine going on in my life. I feel like I was designed for this moment. And that really was – there was an instantaneous realization of that when I was sitting in Andy Wakefield's basement looking at the hour and 45 minutes of documentary he had put together. And, it was all there. It was the information. I was sitting next to a stack from the floor, probably 3.5 feet high, of – the official documents that Thompson provided I could look through. He just said, whatever questions you have, I'll answer them. Whatever you want to look at, it's all transparent to you. Because I was thinking about coming in to produce. But the film really needed what I'd learned to do, which was, I finally, you always hear it as a filmmaker, all the things I wanted to do, I actually had my 10,000 hours in. You hear that point?
Yep.
I had edited 10,000 hours or more of medical information into a show that's supposed to entertain your average person in America. A really weird niche. I mean, honestly, The Doctors was the first show to ever try to make daytime entertainment out of medical information. It was the first one of its kind. It was before Dr. Oz. A lot of people don't know that. And I was there. And so here I am with this really weird, specific training. And what Vax needed was to be more understandable and palatable and emotionally engaging for your average viewer. Mm-hmm. Andy is brilliant. He is so smart. And you've probably had to work this, but I always say people like Andy or other scientists I work with, like James Lyons Weiler or Brian Hooker, they don't realize how smart they are or how stupid the rest of us are, you know? And a lot of with Andy was like, we got to dumb this down. Like, it doesn't make sense. He's like, I've already dumbed it as far as we'll go. I was like, then we're in trouble because I still don't understand it, you know? And if I don't understand it, then most of the audience isn't. But sitting that moment, I just thought, I really thought, oddly enough, I'm the most perfectly designed person to be sitting in this chair right now with what this film needs. What are the odds of that? How does that happen? And so that's the truth. Where would I be? I had sort of been frustrated. You know, my career was going well, but I wanted to be making movies. I didn't want to be in television. Okay. I was frustrated that. And as I said, you know, on the last show, my friends were like, you've won an Emmy Award. Like, what are you – I mean, I won an Emmy Award not even paying attention to my TV job. You know, still, I was shopping a movie. I was a writer. This was just my day job. And through a lot of sort of deep soul searching and some great work with – I did sweat lodges with a great Native American friend of mine and met some great people through there and just talking it out. And there was this moment of clarity where, you know, I remember just thinking, I've been looking and looking and looking. And at one point, you know, you sit in a sweat lodge for people who have ever done it. Like, it's extremely hot and really difficult. And you're sort of dealing with your fears and your concerns. And I remember hearing my friends say, you know, I hear a lot of the same prayers. And there's just no way you're not getting the answers. You're not listening. And in that moment, I just thought, it's true. I've been, you know, looking, you know, everywhere. Why is my film career not happening? Mm-hmm. Why can't I? I mean, I had a screenplay that was doing well. It was being optioned. But it just wasn't getting across the threshold yet. In television, everyone was loving the work that I was doing. And I just had this moment of clarity where I just thought, you know what? Why am I focusing in the place where I'm not wanted, which is in making films and trying to get this movie, whereas TV loves me. All the producers I work with, everyone wants me more involved. Why don't I just focus where the door's open? And it seems obvious, but I think a lot of us make that mistake. I think we are – you know, I always say I was shackled to my 18-year-old dream of who I was supposed to be.
Right.
And it, you know, it had the potential of robbing me of a future. And luckily I woke up in time to say, you have a future. You're just not going through the door that's wide open for you. And so I focused and doubled down on The Doctors. I almost immediately recognized that I was going to let go of this film that I had been pursuing for 10 years. I was only a field producer on The Doctors at the time, which meant I just flew out and shot the surgeries. I didn't produce the show. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, I want to be a show producer, which is a really huge change. People think they're all the same, but there's these tracks you're on. Producing a show where you find guests and come up with a whole concept for an entire episode is much different than just being sent out with a script and asking, you know, asking questions and shooting, you know, some B-roll and things. And I remember, and you probably didn't ask, but I think it's a good story because I think it shows how much I appreciate The Doctors. You know, I went and the moment I said I want to produce, and there's people around me saying, you're not a producer, you're a field. Like, there's field producing is sort of more creative. Producing is very technical. You got to write, you got to put the script together, just things like that. And the moment I thought of it, my producer who I was working for like a day later. This is like those crazy things. She's like, I'm quitting. Huh. I was like, really? She's like, I wanted to be moving into upper management, supervising, producing. They're not moving me there, so I'm out of here. And I called my wife and I said, I am going to try and get a producing job today. It's going to probably mean more hours. I doubt they'll pay me more. I don't think, you know what I mean? But I really think this is the direction I want to go. And I went into the executive producers and I said, I want to produce. And they're like, why? And I said, I think it's where I want to go. And so they said, all right, well, we'll talk about it. And like 2 hours later, I got called into the office by Jay McGraw, Dr. Phil's son. And honestly, up to that moment, he was just this guy that created the show. We didn't have a lot of interactions. And I'll never forget, and I have huge respect for him in this moment. I came in and he said, so I'm told you want to produce the doctors. I said, yeah. And he said, well, you're one of our best field producers, and I don't want to lose you as a field producer, but I'm intrigued by this idea of you producing. So here's what we're going to do. We're not going to give you the title. I'm going to let you produce some shows, you know, and we'll see how it goes. But I want to be able to say you suck at this and not lose you and have you go back to what you're doing. I said, fine, but I wouldn't be here if I didn't think I could do it. He's like, yeah. I got that. And then I said, you know, I'm going to study with the producer that's leaving, and I'm going to sit with everybody. And he said, no, I want to like absolutely mandate that you not do that. I said, what do you mean? He's like, I don't want you to learn how to produce from anyone else. I'm curious to see how would Del Batre produce a doctor's show. And he's like, we'll get you an associate producer that knows the technical side of the things, that like, I don't need you getting buried in that. Produce the show the way you would do it. And I want to tell that story because I've never told that. That takes real vision and it takes courage. And it really was a growth space for me and in how I treat my employees now and what I want from the people that work with me. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, so where would I be? I suppose. I think within two shows, my shows were rating. It just, I was a different type of producer. I was doing things differently. You know, I had a show where there was a girl that was dying who was pregnant and had cancer. And in order to fight the cancer, they were going to have to terminate the baby. And she decided to carry the baby. And I did a show where we made a time capsule for her child, which she was not going to live, you know. And so we dealt with death. And that was something that was a known. By the way, the producers were angry at me that I did it. They're like, you promised her what? I was like, I said if she'd come on the show, we would create a time capsule for her to leave for her baby, the things she would want him to know throughout the milestones of their life. And it scared the heck out of the show. But they're like, you can't have you promise that and not follow through. And a couple months later, she actually came forward and said, okay, I want to do it. And that show, I think, really pushed the envelope of anything a daytime talk show had ever done. No one ever talked about death, yet it's something we all deal with all the time. And it was powerful. And I mean, you couldn't watch that show and not really be moved. Mm. And so those are the things that – so where would I be? I'd be continuing to move people in any way that I felt was intriguing to me. And I guess that's what it really is, you know. I think as an artist, if you're going to be successful in those moments where I question, you know, what am I doing here? Or, you know, early on working for the Dr. Phil show and getting screamed at and yelled at, there's an intensity to TV. And just thinking, I can try to figure out what they want, but I will never really know what they want. I should probably just try to do what I would want to see. You know, I want to just put out what would grab my attention on television. And every time I really got truthful with that, and I just thought either what I care about is what people care about or it's not, and I shouldn't be in this business. So I would just be continuing to follow the things that intrigue me, and that's why I'm here. Yeah. This vaccine issue is so fascinating to me, more than just the truth, more than, you know, whether I'm here to save children. This issue encompasses everything that's wrong with society. Mm-hmm. It's got it all wrapped up. Mm-hmm. The media is lying to us. It's owned by an industry. Our government is owned by an industry. They're not even looking at the truth. Scientists who I think are avoiding looking into the – just opening the right door that's right in front of them. Is it – you know, I'm fascinated by, are they lying to us? Is Paul Offit lying, or does he really believe it? And mostly I think these people mostly believe what they're into, but there's something about – you know, my fascination right now is there's something about – our subconscious, or what drives us, that actually protects us in a way so that in order to feel like we're doing what's right, these scientists are avoiding asking the most obvious questions. Right. And I think we think that they're doing it on purpose, but I think we have such a brilliant mechanism inside of us, it actually does that job for us. The question that's obvious to a third grader right now on vaccines is not a question that's obvious to Francis Collins, who's the head of the National Institute of Health right now, which is, why aren't you curious about the health outcomes of vaccinated compared to unvaccinated children? Why aren't you curious enough to do that study? And he looks at I watched Bobby Kennedy set a table. I watched Bobby Kennedy ask that question in a meeting set up by Donald Trump. And he legitimately, passionately said, we can't figure out a way to do that study.
Yeah.
You can't figure out a way to compare two groups of individuals to each other?
Right.
Like what?
Well, yeah. I mean, our government told the CDC or HHS to do that study 10 years ago.
Right.
And they said, okay, we'll do a study to see if we can do the study.
Right.
And they did that study to see if they could do the study, and they figured out, well, we can't do the study.
According to the results of the first study.
The test study.
We can't do the real study.
No, but I love that, and I've said this the most a lot of times. I could just talk about vaccines all day long.
Yeah.
I mean, it fascinates me. I love to be challenged to learn something new, and just with our reading and our discussions, like every so often a new nugget will just hit and I'll learn something new. I'm like, oh, I never even thought of that before. And then it just energizes me to continue the conversation. But yeah, I mean, you're right. You have to love what you do.
Yeah.
And especially if you're going to go outside the box and, you know, go against the grain, you really have to love it. And if you do, it just makes it that much more personally rewarding to just be in the fight.
Yeah.
Satisfying just to be in the fight. Otherwise, it's a drag, right? And
yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine doing this.
You don't make it. There's no way you stay here. I mean, there's no way. Like, it's such a – and this is where, like, people aren't all writers. They're not all psychologists. They're not all coming from – you know, not artists, so I get it. But what you've been led to believe about how a human being works – you just really, you know, growing up in theater as I did, and you study humanity. You know, I study people. As an actor, I learned to study what makes someone tick. Mm-hmm. As a writer, I had to write for the bad guys just as well as I write for the good guys. You've got to put yourself in that headspace.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and we've done that a lot lately. Yeah. It's not just about vaccines and diseases. It's about the people involved in this injury and why they think the way they do, why they believe the way they do.
And
that's a huge part of it.
And this idea that an Andy Wakefield would be at it this long just to defend his reputation or to – I mean if he really – if it was a hoax, if he committed fraud, do you really think he'd be stepping in front of television cameras?
Why not just disappear?
He would have walked
later,
away.
Like, all right, it's done. You lost. They called you on it. Like, what are you doing here? You don't fight to continue to prove your fraud was correct unless you actually believe and know you were right and the fraud is against you. I mean, that's just – and people that repeat these stories like an Anderson Cooper, are you a moron? You're a reporter. You've interviewed, you know, more people than I have. What is it that you think makes Andy tick? Like, what do you think that guy is? And by the way, explain to me the 12 other scientists that signed onto this study. This wasn't one man, one fraud. They weren't 12 idiots. Right. It's impossible. What you're describing is impossible. It would be impossible to create a fraud and have 12 of the world's leading scientists all sign their name to it. People mm-hmm. don't sign their name to studies, especially ones that in it say that the MMR vaccine is being blamed by the parents in this study for causing autism. It wasn't lost on any of his co-authors on that study that this was going to draw a lot of negative attention.
Right.
You can be guaranteed they tested every single thing he said, everything that was written in there, every I was dotted, every T was crossed. It defies any reason whatsoever to say and the credit you would have to give Andy at that point. I mean, I know I'm way off topic here, but this is to be totally honest, you're not just saying he's a fraud. You're saying he had to have been one of the greatest diabolical masterminds the world has ever seen, that he could pull the wool over 12 of the top scientists' eyes right in front of them and do it for the world to see. That's that type of person is only fictitious. That doesn't exist.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, I appreciate you using as an example of why does it keep fighting?
Right. Why are we here?
So I want to talk about ICANN, Informed Consent Action Network.
Yes.
ICANNdecide.org. I'm just curious how did that come about? When did it start? Whose idea was it? Was it your idea? Was it some of your friends? Walk us through the beginnings of it and.
Well, someday I'll probably write a book really – there's certain things that I have to be careful not to give too much detail about mm-hmm. some of the people. There's inspirations. Yeah. There's people behind this movement mm-hmm. that don't want to be known.
Right.
You know, and that – that make all of this possible. But the truth is ICANN really came out of the fact that I was touring the country with Vaxxed. We had purchased this bus with Vaxxed written on the side of it. It was this driving memorial. People were signing their names on the side of it, whether their children were injured or had passed away. And so this powerful experience. You know, I had wanted to rig cameras all inside of that bus to try and make it like a reality show so that people could see in real time mm-hmm. what we were experiencing on the road. Mm-hmm. But the truth is we just could never get the technology to work. Like it just – we had cameras in there, but the bus was already old. The bus was breaking down more often. The guy I had putting the system in anew, who a lot of people know, was spending more time keeping the bus driving than we could put into really trying to figure out how to create some sort of satellite system that could broadcast from a bus and let people really see what was going on. We had Periscope. We had Facebook, but I wanted something more. And Polly was doing such an amazing job, my co-producer, one of the co-producers on Vaxxed, interviewing these parents. We were traveling mm-hmm. to screenings. We would do Q&As. She wasn't particularly fond of doing the Q&As. She was really jazzed by interviewing the parents after they'd seen the film and have them. Right. So we were finding our niches. And Andy was, he'd already spent his life touring on this issue. He didn't want to sit on a bus, to be perfectly honest, he wanted to be on making the next film, which is something he's very passionate about. So everyone was sort of finding their way out of Vax. We've been on the road for, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 months. And I wanted to do more. And there was also people in our group that wanted to see, we've been looking for a lawyer. We've been looking for a legal approach. And we decided to really get focused on the legal side. And also, one of the things that really sort of shocked me was I think it was Mississippi that had brought Vaxxed into town, and we drove the bus up and they said, meet at the state capitol. It was the first time someone said, Del, come in and talk to our representatives. Like we've got some meetings set up for you. I had never done that before. My mom actually was a bit of a, activist. So I tailed with her when she'd gone to a march or two and maybe had spoken to a politician once or twice, but I was never going to be that person. That doesn't come – I didn't think mm-hmm. it would come naturally to me. And, I got dragged into this office and I think if it wasn't the first meeting, the second one, I said, oh, my God, I love this. this is – and it's sort of what we talked about in the last episode. Yeah. It was a debate. Yeah. Like suddenly, like I'm really curious about this person and what it is, you know, you think about vaccines, and try to find in the game of having 5 or 10 minutes to walk in, try and figure out what makes this person tick, kind of run through, you know, you have this way of like, I'm going to run a bunch of ideas and see where I get some sort of, I can get a,
no, you're,
a
you're,
glimmer.
You're so right. Yeah. Like, you know? I hate trying to set up legislator meetings, but if someone else sets it up and brings me in, you're so right. I love to try to read them, try to understand them. What is their motivation? What do they really want out of this bill? Yeah. And then you're right. Every meeting is different.
Yeah.
You're always saying different things depending on where that goes. And you're right. I actually completely enjoyed that part of those meetings. I just hate all the politics of it.
Yeah.
Right? And then you learn what resonates with people.
Right.
And you're learning what makes them open their consciousness for a second when something strikes a chord.
Yeah.
And then that becomes part of your arsenal.
Yeah.
For what you can use.
No, you definitely,
again.
And you know, and this is what I say to people. You got to test your, you know, try it on your friends, try it on your family. There are things that I've said like, oh, that didn't work. That backfired. In fact, that got me down a road. You know, like it just that didn't turn out well. And let me not do that again. And so you find the things that really resonate. Mm-hmm. But every person does, you know, I sort of have, you know, a cadre of different approaches. And I kind of shuffle through them in front of somebody until I just saw that you cared about that.
Right.
So let's focus there. For someone, it might be religious, aborted field, you know, cell lines or, you know, whatever. But so that was a sort of talent that reared its head. I mean, I had just discovered I really like talking in front of audiences, doing these Q&As.
Do you? Yeah. We don't get that.
No, you can't tell. You can't tell.
like the fanfare.
Yeah. I was just at the WAVE conference, the chiropractic conference here a couple weeks ago. And the first time ever Vax was pulling through, I think it was San Francisco 3 years ago. And we were at WAVE just to people, they wanted to have the bus come by. And then someone said, do you want to get up and speak? And I was like, well, I don't know. I mean, I had been doing Q&As. I could answer questions. And of course, I rambled on and, you know, but I hadn't done like a prepared talk. I was like, well, how long do you want me to talk for? It's like 30 minutes. And I remember thinking, 30 minutes?
Yeah.
How am I going to fill?
And this is before you'd ever done talks.
How am I going to fill 30 minutes?
Well, it's like a monologue. Right?
It was easy for you, right?
And it went by pretty easily. I was like, oh, that wasn't so bad. And of course, now anyone knows me. I'm like, you know, if you're bringing me in, it's like 30 minutes. Like, no, I won't have been. I can't. I'm just.
That's my intro.
I'm getting intro. Yeah, like 30 minutes. But so anyway, all those things were going on. Really came about that. There was this legislative side. I really was flying around. I was in airplanes more than I was on the bus. And, you know, some of the funding and things that were coming in wanted to see, you know, a legal approach. And I was like, right, nobody's really covering the legal side. And again, the moment we really started discussing what would be our legal approach, you know, we ran into a legal team that had already been thinking about this. And so it just sort of naturally happened. And so there's a strategy to it, of which I can't talk about. I mean, and that's what's really hard.
Yeah.
The hardest thing about right now, and I know we're going to get into it, is there are things you can talk about. I'm all about being transparent. I'm not trying to hide from people, but genuinely, if I tell you, then my next legal case is going to be in jeopardy because I'm already letting the other side know where we're coming from.
Right.
We've, you know, our Health and Human Services lawsuit, our National Institute of Health lawsuit, our lawsuits against FDA. We've had, I think, over 150 or 75 FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests. We are taking a different approach than everybody else ever had.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at you. It's really hard to come through the front door. They have really protected this vaccine issue like Fort Knox. You can't sue doctors. You can't sue the vaccine maker. You can't sue Walgreens. You can't sue – you can't talk about, you know, a product defective qualities. I mean, Supreme Court got involved, everything around it. But we did something different. We looked at the 1986 Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, this law that took liability away in 1986, where everyone else was only talking about, we've got to repeal this, we've got to get rid of this, this is the end of the world. Instead, we decided to look at it differently. Is there anything in there that gives us a, you know, a manhole we can crawl into and actually get inside this system and find a legal course there? And that's where we've been.
And I think most people don't realize that the 1986 law was not a vaccine law. It like had five or six different other elements, and the vaccine component was just one part of it.
Right.
And it had some it allowed pharmaceutical companies to be able to sell products overseas without having testing. There were several things that were part of that law.
It brought in VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, a national reporting system. I mean, there were some things that you could see. And by the way, a lot of people don't recognize that all sides were at the table. You know, Barbara Lowe Fisher, I've had some really fascinating conversations with her. She was at the table fighting for the 1986 law. We really only look at it in a negative light now, but it was really supposed to benefit people with injured children.
Right, but back then no one knew they were going to throw in pharma liability.
Correct.
Like that was like a surprise at the very end that, that I think – you know, Barbara and no one would have, you know, even entered that
There's
game.
A lot to be learned there.
That was going to happen. Yeah.
And this was Henry Waxman at the time, who was a Democrat in California that brought, that was bringing this to light, this vaccine component. It's super interesting to go into the history of just the actual bill that was presented.
Yeah, and we're going to have Barbara on here
in a
couple of months probably to hear her experience, because that's kind of her life story.
And I think you should really press her to really discuss, because I think that we need to be having more discussions about the 86 Act. I think there's a lot of talk about we have to repeal it, but, you know, all important discussions. And frankly, I don't know what the exact answer is. Yeah. Do we repeal it completely? Because if we do, we lose VAERS. It would be nice to have VAERS be more accurate than capturing 1%.
Like
we have ways to be much more successful at tracking vaccine injury, which would be really important information. And Barbara, you know, she'll – if you ask it, it's really interesting to get into the dangers of repealing theirs.
I'm sorry for Zandel. Melissa's hungry, and so she needs a snack.
Okay,
so
very good. Gonna, go have at it.
Try to very quietly.
So anyway, ICANN was multiple things. It was a legal recourse. We ended up – I wanted to be speaking more. I wanted to be working, looking at legislation. Talking to politicians more. And really, it was the investigation part of it. I was on a bus only talking about MMR vaccine and a fraud at the CDC. Yet everywhere we traveled, more parents were saying the DTaP vaccine caused their child's autism.
Yes.
You know, more
or hepatitis B or all the different injuries.
And I was like, wow, there's other vaccines. Yeah. And then there were people asking me, is it only the MMR vaccine? And I didn't have an answer to that. But what really bothered me was people coming up and saying, well, thank God we saw vaccines. We're going to avoid the MMR vaccine. We'll do the other ones, but we'll avoid the MMR. And I just thought, I don't know that that was the point of the film.
It's not just about that.
I mean, it's kind of about the whole process in general. But I didn't really have enough information. And so ICANN really afforded me the ability to then take the next step, which was a full and complete investigation really into one word of the vaccine program, and that's safety. I've done very little to look at. We're only now starting to look at effective. So when you hear vaccines are safe and effective right now, because as I said in the last podcast that we did together, I think we've won the scientific argument that you cannot say vaccines are safe. There's no way to scientific. You don't have the scientific evidence. And I've had top scientists that have challenged me on this.
Yeah.
And I said, show me. And they all admit it in the end. And you're going to start seeing some of that come out. There's science coming from places that no one will believe that. I mean, you know, Peter Gutcha, you know, has just stood up and put out an incredible paper speaking out about the DPT vaccine and the work by Peter Abe. Are they both Peters? Am I getting that right?
I hope so.
Anyway, the science proves out. And so all of that, we looked at safety and we've challenged the government. I've been, I think, in the most thorough debate with Health and Human Services with ICANN that's ever happened.
I know.
That's ever happened.
I'm going to ask you about that.
All right,
ICANN is How many people are we talking? Like, I mean, I know a lot of it is behind the scenes.
Yeah. I would say there's probably, you know, all in all, 18.
Right, right.
People, maybe.
It's a good team. Good size of a
maybe
team.
Maybe between all the media, legal department, you know, all that we do. I think we're doing the work of 100 people. I mean, I'll be honest that, you know, for instance, the High Wire, you know, what we pull off on that show and the way it comes together, you know, we have a handful of people that are doing what I'm used to working with, you know, 30 to 50 people.
Well, I love what you said. You said, you know, a while ago that the to gather the right people around you, you know, is a huge deal, and it's very important. And that's really the key to being successful in any of these endeavors is really having the absolute right people around you. And, so who did someone kind of like, who was the brainchild with you, I guess, behind ICANN? I mean, if you can say, I mean,
that I can talk. The first real hire was Catherine Layton,
I think of her as Cat.
Cat. Patrick was driving the bus, Cat's husband.
Cat and Pat,
you know,
yeah.
And so I had a decent relationship with Patrick. I mean, I knew him as bus driver and opera singer, you know what I mean? And a guy who was really trying to heal their two injured children, you know. And I was amazed that there was, you know, a wife at home with two injured kids while Patrick was dedicating his life to the bus. And I'll never forget the moment I met Patrick. It was actually Patrick who had a screening of Vaxxed in Orange County. And it was the first time we had several, I forget how long we'd been on the road, maybe a few weeks. It was early on. And we showed up and there was people wrapped around the building and down the block. I mean, we hadn't seen an audience like that.
Yeah. I went to Eliso Viejo, and I also went to somewhere up.
You'd have to ask them because I don't know Orange County well. Yeah, and I, you know, but I just, and it was two showings. I mean, we came out of that first showing, and there was
Dad came to one of those showings too.
And there was a line again for the second showing. And Patrick came up to me, and I said, "This is amazing what you've done here." I mean, they found the theater. They talked the theater into doing it. They got all these grassroots going to get people to buy those tickets. And it was really amazing to me that they'd gone through this effort. And I'll never forget, Patrick sort of stopped me outside of the theater. And he looked me in the eyes. He like grabbed me, you know, sort of both shoulders and said, I need to ask you something really important. I was like, okay. And he said something like, you know, I have two injured children, and I'm here because that matters to me more than anything. And I want to know, are you for real? I said, what do you mean? He's like, I hope what I've done here, I'm not just like bolstering somebody that's just in this and out of this and is just going to, you know, that you're just getting off on this or somehow. Like, are you here? Do you really care? And it was like, he was serious. I was like, well,
this is after he'd been driving the bus for a while?
No, this is before. Oh, before. When I first met him.
Okay.
But that sounds like the question of a concerned parent who is tired of feeling hopeful about things that you continue to be disappointed with.
Right.
And that it's so fearful to put this faith into the idea that there is a chance something could get better and that the exposure could come out and a solution could come and kids could get healed and prevent injuries, that I think a lot of parents that have been in that personal situation, and I'm speaking from my personal experience too, that sometimes you sort of just feel like the odds are always against you, that everybody's a shady character on some level. You become so jaded. You think there's no possible way that people are in this necessarily for the right reasons because it's always working against us.
Yeah.
And so I kind of can see why he would have come at you that way, just because I think that is every parent who has been so hurt and their world has been so shocked by what they thought was true that is not true anymore. And their entire consciousness has shifted to a place of, I cannot trust anyone. There is nobody telling me the truth anymore, even within our own movement. I totally resonate with what he would say because I would probably feel a lot of the same things.
Yeah. And I still, I know that there's, you know, there's two parts of this movement right now that I think we're all struggling to help keep united, which is you really have the vaccine injured families, or the ex-vaxxers, or whatever we want to call that, that are the heart of this movement. They're really, truly, to me, the heroes that sent a warning signal out to people like me and families like mine that you don't want to do this. But now we have this really growing body of, you know, true anti-vaxxers, or people that really are not vaccinating their kids at all, that are living pharma-free. And those are two different motivations.
I wouldn't call – I don't know if I'd call those people anti-vaxxers. Well, only
I'm getting less
worried about the word
with that, just because I'm tired of wasting energy on it.
But just don't you feel like it's this label that is – because it's been used in such a negative way that, like, essentially claiming it claims that? Or, I mean, do you think there's a real way to be able to say that and say it in like a – I'm vaccine free. We live a holistic way that does not include medical interventions. Do you think that's the same thing as an anti-vaxxer the way the world knows it?
No. I mean, we aren't anti-vaxxers. I've already made that point clear. But I do also look at, like, there's, you know, when you look at movements that have been before us, you know, the African American, you know, movement had to just, they grabbed the N-word and they just said, fine. At a certain point, we're going to own this. I think that we have to think about whether that's the move we make too, which is, you know, we could get bogged down in semantics here, and you're trying to make this a derogatory term. You're using it like that. But at some point, do we just own whatever that stigma is? Because fighting it is just a waste of more words, and we need to get to the point. So, you know, I'm on the fence. I haven't really and I've come up with, you know, vaccine educated or
we've
you know,
tried to I, come I, up with
right,
terms
right.
as well.
And this is it's just nothing sexy enough yet. That I just haven't, you know. But to get back to, so then how did ICANN came together. Well, so I was just saying, we're on the bus, Patrick's driving, and there's this moment where we were going to and it was right when I'm starting to look and talking to Polly, and I was going to call it, I think I wanted to use Vaxxed as a nonprofit. So it'd be like, you know, Vaxxed, you know, would become a movement or something. So it was discussion, do I take the name? It's like a lot of things that were behind the scenes going on. But while that was going on, we found out that there was going to be an event in New York City at a hospital there where Paul Offit and Senator Richard Pan were having a symposium on how to stop the anti-vaxxers. And we wanted the bus across the street. You know, we wanted to be there. And Catherine, I think, had just come to visit Patrick on the bus. And I said, you know, do you think you could, you know, we're all busy. Do you think maybe she's like, I want something to do. I was like, could you try and see if you can book us, get the some sort of pass to be in the city with the bus across from that hospital? She said, I guess. I mean, I've never tried something like that. And I said, look, I have location scouts in that can help you with how to do it. I brought in some producers to talk to. And I remember she was talking to these people that were pros at it that I'd set her up with. But, you know, you need to get everything signed and done. And we had like maybe a week we're out. And about 3 days in, I was like, how's it going? She's like, I don't know, man. It's a lot of red tape. And, you know, I'm doing what I'm being told. And like day four, she calls me and Kat just said, Del, can I just do this the way I would do it? Like, can I like, I just feel like all of your friends are making this much more complicated than it needs to be. I was like, well, I mean, they work in New York City. Yeah, okay, fine, you know. And like 3 hours later, she's like, I got the permit. I was like, what? She's like, yeah, there's better ways to do things like this. And I was like, that was amazing. And then we pulled up and we had like cones that had blocked the street, and the bus pulls up right across in the middle of New York City. New York City, you don't get permits like that. And in that moment, I just thought, will you run Informed Consent Action Network? I want someone that gets the job done like that.
Creatively,
like outside the box. Yeah. I don't know how to do it.
Get
you
it
didn't
done.
Know how to do it, but you get it done. And Kat is absolutely one of the most efficient, brilliant thinkers, movers, and she really has done a brilliant job. And so it started with the two of us, really, like building out from there. And it was only later that Patrick got involved, you know, so we sort of, you know, have grown from there.
So if I really want something done, or I email Kat.
Kat's the brains of the outfit, absolutely.
I've been emailing Pat all this time.
Well, Pat runs the high wire. He's sort of the creative producer there. And then, of course, I brought in Jen Sherry from The Doctors. I stole another producer who's now the executive producer of all the things, all the media we're creating, which has been awesome. And so we're expanding there, and more we want to do with media. Some exciting new thoughts for our new – I kind of look at this right now as sort of our new season, even though we never announced it that way. We're coming out of summer. We've sort of all been taking time off here and there, but there's new things that we want to do. And I think new places we have to go with media.
You mean like interview Dr. Bob and I? Well, is that what you mean on the high wire? Is that what you're saying?
Hey, I've
in
you've
studio?
Been on before. We've had you on.
In studio.
Love to come in studio, though. Let's
make that happen.
Really get
hey,
down.
Not a two-minute
I'm not
going
to tell the world
segment.
That I've offered it a million times and you didn't want to be seen with me. But
don't be giving us the ending segment before the credits either.
You're so right about when you find the person that you know that can really kind of help make things happen and becomes a great partner. I mean, I call it having a Melissa is what I call it.
Yeah.
So is Kat like who is your is Kat your Melissa or do
yeah?
You, do you have
I mean,
other
there's,
there
is
there?
There's no I can without Kat.
Yeah,
and, I like and, that. And, that sounds like a shirt.
Yeah, that probably would be a very
no
good
I
shirt.
Can
and
yeah.
look, I essentially feel that way about. Everyone that's involved because in this I was just talking to somebody else that's you know a leader in a part of this movement is out there and I'm honest with anyone that comes to work with me first of all this could really hurt your career I mean I made that choice I don't want you to come in blindly I don't want you know I want you to know what you're doing here and I need you to be passionate about it.
Yeah,
because,
for sure.
you know, we're essentially in a war. It's a war of thought. I hate using that word because they're trying to label us with some violent tone. It's not violence, but we're really, we have got to have each other's backs and we've got to be, I need people that are working that care enough to put in all of that extra work it's going to take.
Yeah.
That aren't just riding along. We don't have the funding for that. Right. I need people working double.
It's not a job.
Time.
It's not a regular job.
It's not a job. We're all.
It's not a paycheck.
Passionate here, and if you're not passionate, and there's been people who've come and gone, you know, in with us, and I never no guilt. Like I'm usually say, you know what, this isn't for you. It's totally cool. We're crazy, you know. We're obsessed with something, and have a passion about it. That doesn't mean you have to have that, you know, and so. What remains and what continues, we are growing. We're growing every year, but there's some coming and going until the right pieces really fall into place. And
But like Pat said to you at that theater, he grabbed your shoulders and said, "You know, are you for real?" And I think the character of somebody, I think, is so critical to being effective in this and the success of our movement is just the you know you have to really have a high level of good moral character and then be very passionate about it but you have to be real you have to be authentic and you have to have that inner passion to really really want to do it and I'm just curious, what did you say to Pat when he asked you that and
I said,
because he probably knew that he probably knew you know he wanted to make sure the person leading this was
I said all anyone can say which is I mean I'm committed but that I remember thinking I don't know that that's convincing only time can prove that out
I think that's
there's been a lot of challenges of – I mean I could tell early on that even Barbara Lo Fisher, I hope she doesn't mind. But I felt like she was watching me for the first year. Like it wasn't – she wouldn't really talk with me, you know. At a certain point, I think she finally – you know, we were speaking. And we would sort of see each other across rooms. And I think that at a certain point – and rightfully so – I don't mean this in any way. I would be questioning who's this new person, this person that worked for a pharmaceutical show. The hell is this person, you know? But I remember really at a certain point, you know, we sort of reached out and we met at a speaking engagement, and she really engaged me and questioned some of my motives and tried to correct some of the things she thought I maybe wasn't fully nailing. And we've had a really great relationship since.
Well, I remember kind of not wanting my picture taken with some, other big figures in the movement, because I didn't always know what the reputation was going to be like. But I think, I've come to the point of I think we all know who in the movement is authentic and is, does have, that high character. And I feel like I'm happy to get my picture taken with anybody at this point. But I think, I'm very happy to get my picture taken with Andy, because we know he's a person of very high moral character, and Barbara, of course. But I feel like I was hesitant about that, a few years ago. Do I want to be interviewed by this person or that person? And so I think I was a lot more cautious back then. But yeah, you're right. As you get to know people and their true motivations, you know they're a total partner in this.
And there's a lot to that. I mean, and frankly, the movement's changing.
Yeah.
You know, the perception of us is changing. You know, we're growing and shifting with sort of the different structure and stature that we have. I mean, I think that, some of the things we get in trouble for from people that are watching is that, why did you do that? Or like, there's calculations to the decisions, the things we're saying, we're doing. And by the way, I want to really make it clear that, there's all these discussions about leaders of movements. Anyone that tries to say I'm a leader, like, that's ridiculous.
Right, you know
what I mean? And
that's how we feel.
There's a lot of discussions about, we need to bring this movement together and unite this movement. And I caution, all the think tanks that I get into where people say that, I say, well, I actually think we're doing pretty good. And I think if I was going to say to sort of put some judgment on those brilliant people that came before us, I think there were attempts to be a strong, united movement that break out into ego battles of who's in charge, who's writing the talking points, whose talking points are we going to listen to.
And then it stifles everyone's work because everyone's like waiting around, waiting for the leader.
And it creates infighting because at that point it becomes more divisive. That's the thing I was going to say is a lot of people don't know who's in this for the right reasons, because you do get, unfortunately, some people that come into this movement thinking this is their chance at fame.
Yeah.
And they come into this movement.
Rare, but yes.
It's not a lot, but the problem is that usually when somebody new comes on the scene that's kind of capturing attention, people want to believe this person is a good person and they're going to get us there. And people have been burned by certain people not being about the solution, but being about pushing their own viewpoint or what they think it has to happen. And just like you're saying, especially in California, there are so many different groups and so many different quote unquote leaders, and everybody has a different idea about what will work, what is successful, what messaging points there needs to be. And nobody's really willing to create a hierarchy to say like, well, okay, we're all going to have the conversation, but in the end, we're going to trust these people to sort of come up with it. And so it's always an impasse. It ends up becoming staying at the same. And I've heard a lot of conversation about, we need to unite this. And it feels like a much bigger task than people realize. It's not like, let's just all come together on this day at this time, and we're just going to magically do it. Because they've tried that. And what ends up happening is nothing.
Right.
And so, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say, like, maybe that's not necessary.
Yeah. I mean, what I like to see is everyone figures out what they're really good at and what they're passionate about and what they enjoy doing. And you focus on that. You work hard in that area because there's other people doing something else you don't like to do.
Right.
And there's people working the legislators, and there's people, behind the scenes. And,
and
we love
the rallies.
We love talking, and we love, coming up with ideas and talking to the public. We love, talking to the grassroots public.
Yeah, we like
to. And so I'm not going to try to control what people are doing with the legislators because that's not my thing. So I kind of like that we are, and there's, probably, I don't know, five or six, major groups of people working on this stuff in California. I think we're each doing the part that we're good at and are going to be successful at and enjoy doing. I think that's better than us all trying to be one big thing, because I just don't know if that's possible.
Well, yes, and I think that that's true. And so, you know, talking about ICANN, I would say that, you know, a great part of the work that I do with ICANN is trying to mediate to keep groups getting along with each other as we discuss this, yeah. You know. Vaxxed was special that way. I mean, when Vaxxed came out, my understanding of the movement through Andy and Polly and people that we were interviewing was, Dell, this is a very fractured movement and group of people that, you know, you're going to have to be ready for that. Vaxxed had a uniting thing to it that sort of transcended all of the baloney that I think people have been with, and really got people to say, we're in this together and this is much bigger than all of us.
For sure.
I think we have to work right now very, very hard to maintain that. I do. California has been scary. I've watched us slipping into arguments and fighting and, you know, my way or the highway, or this is the only way to do this. And everywhere I go, and we'll get to this at the end, but I'll probably say something similar, which is just everyone, you know, you aced math, I aced English. We're going to approach this thing differently. You know what I mean?
Like, but we can still be in the same class.
We can still be in the same class. Yeah. And, you know, if it's a mathematical problem, then take the lead. If it's, you know, a language problem, then I got it. But I think we need to do what we're guided. I keep saying, I think we're all being guided to do what we're supposed to do. Yeah. What we need to stop doing is judging each other.
Everybody else's efforts.
Judging everybody's efforts. Does it come up? Is it, you know, is that the right way? Yeah. Is there a right way? I think that we're stronger because as a movement, there are so many different things that different people care about. Different states care about different things.
Totally.
Large states have different issues, whether you're in this county or that, or, you know, there's diversity. And there's always diversity.
Yeah.
We should celebrate the diversity because, and frankly, I think that putting, you know, if we all agreed to a singular languaging and put ourselves on one front, we're much easier to beat.
Yeah.
I think what makes
this more limited.
It's much more limited. Yeah. I think that we've got really great opinions on coming from multiple sides. We have so many great speakers and ideas and thought leaders that maybe don't necessarily agree exactly, but we have a similar goal, which is to really bring the truth to light and the fact that, you know, these vaccines can be dangerous for some set of
What would you say is the favorite success that ICANN has had, you know, in the last couple of years? And, you know, looking back at the things you've achieved, different lawsuits, HHS, I mean, what would you say was your favorite or your most exciting? Like, I don't know, what did you kind of go like, yes, we got it, or we got them, or?
Well, let him answer. He just gave me.
No, you know, I need that time. It's really.
In other words,
it's really hard to say. I mean, I'll say that there's so many times where we think, oh my God, that was an amazing day. Yeah. Look at what we just achieved. We just got, you know, Market Watch just published. You know, we just got published by Yahoo on the fact that we won a lawsuit against Health and Human Services. And you know, we got the title to say vaccine skeptics versus calling us anti-vaxxers. And I would say that probably at least 20 times we thought we'll never be what that moment was. And to be honest, I don't even remember what moment I'm talking about, except that I've had that thought.
But there were 20 of them.
and there's been times where the very next day something even bigger would happen.
That's so cool.
And so I think the lawsuits were huge. I think that, you know, winning the case against Health and Human Services and showing the world, I mean, for people that don't understand, you know, when we went at the 86 Act, we took liability away from an industry that was losing money on vaccines.
Right.
I mean, that's how the Institute of Medicine describes the situation in 1985-86. The industry was being sued so often and so effectively because of death and injury by vaccines that they could not make a profit. I mean, you really right. have to try and wrap your head around that. In fact, I said it, you know, probably 1,000 times before it really sunk into me. Wait a minute. It couldn't make a profit. We're talking about the pharmaceutical industry that makes billions off of everything they do, right? Mm-hmm. This was something that was so flawed that they were losing money. And they basically essentially blackmail the government. Right. There were other people at the table. We could get, you know, we've talked about that. But they're like, we're going to stop making vaccines unless you protect us from liability. Mm-hmm. So that moment is fascinating as a historical look and a look at an industry that is really good at making money. This is a product they couldn't make money on because it was so problematic. So then when you look at the 86 Act and when we looked at it, you see that Reagan hated this idea. Congress Correct. Is terrified of it. Like, Right. well, we're going to take liability away from probably, you know, the least trustworthy industry the world has ever seen. That's Okay. crazy. I mean, we're Yeah. talking crazy. And it doesn't make sense if you really look at it. But when we did it, and there were, you know, there was some – I mean, I understand some of the thinking behind why our government, if we think vaccines are the future of the world, then maybe we should protect them from liability. But – our government knew they had a problem, and you read it right in the law. Mm-hmm. It says right there, we've just essentially taken on this very dangerous, problematic product that is got issues in being sued. We got to fix that problem.
Right.
So since it's now our problem, here's what we're going to do. There were two major provisions that we looked at. One was to begin with, who's going to be responsible to evolve the science on this, to do proper studies and make the process of making vaccines more transparent so that we can understand how perhaps it's injuring certain subsets or large groups mm-hmm. or the numbers. And that will be a task force that is mandated by the law that will be headed by the head of the National Institute of Health, you know, will work with the head – it'll be the head of the National Institute of Health, the head of the FDA, and head of the CDC. Those three entities will run a task force to make vaccines safer and more effective. Makes perfect sense. So we subpoenaed – or we used FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, and said we want to see all the recommendations made by the task force mandated by the 1986 Act. Additionally, that task force was going to report to Health and Human Services. Mm-hmm. And Health and Human Services would then – was mandated by the law to meet every 2 years with the Congress and explain how the task force was making vaccines safer, what the future of vaccines was going to be, and how we were getting rid of the adverse events that were obviously crippling this industry. Right. And so Freedom of Information Act, we asked – for that, we wanted the meeting minutes. We said we want to see all of the statements made by Health and Human Services during those every 2 year meetings since 1986 yeah. with Congress. Really simple.
Yeah.
And they refused to answer us. And we were like, why are you refusing? This is public record. Like, what did you recommend to Congress? It's that simple. And we used – there's sort of a – I forget if you call it an executive action, but Freedom of Information Act, you have 30 days as a government to respond to a citizen. That's, so we were citizens. We were representing citizens with ICANN, and they refused. So we brought the – you know, it was executive action, some sort of action, and they refused again. So we took them to court, and we said, we're going to sue you then. We're going to sue for the information that you have got to give us. So there was two lawsuits. One, we want all the recommendations made by the task force. Two, we want how those recommendations were used and transferred in these meetings with Congress. Of course, Health and Human Services comes back to us and says, we never had a single meeting.
Yeah.
Not one.
Yeah.
Not one. It's supposed to be every 2 years since 1986. Yeah. We never met on and the issue.
After all these years, I don't think any of us knew that.
Right. No one
until you guys
right.
decided to pursue this.
And additionally, the task force that was really directly supposed to be working on – pharmaceuticals not doing it. They're not making – they're not evolving the product. So the task force has got to be doing it. We said, what are the recommendations to Health and Human Services? Same thing. They fought us, pushed back, wouldn't give us an answer. We sued them, and they ended up saying, we never formed the task force.
Oh, gosh.
So the only two real provisions that were supposed to fix a broken product that's being injected into our children – and by the way, the moment this law passes, we go from 11 vaccines to now 72 vaccines. So the industry explodes. No one fixes the problems of the product.
Yeah.
And so those were huge moments for ICANN to show the world you're in serious jeopardy. And by the way, these same people are admitting to you there was never a safety study even on the original vaccines or any of the ones coming out right now. We don't do safety studies, and we're doing no science to evolve this product. You're still on 200-year-old science. You're essentially on polio vaccine science and smallpox vaccine science.
And then even if they had formed that task force, if one of those three people on the task force was the head of the CDC – well, guess what?
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Gerberding, the head of the CDC, would have been on the task force. She had $4.5 million worth of Merck stock.
Right.
Exactly.
And so even if they had formed the task force, you think someone who owns stock in Merck is gonna, you know, launch such an investigation? But you know, that's a whole nother topic. But I think my favorite thing that I've seen ICANN do lately is uncovering your letters with HHS and uncovering, you guys literally basically looked at every single FDA package insert and all the licensing safety studies that got each vaccine licensed. Mm-hmm. And you essentially looked for if they ever even once used an inert placebo in any of those safety studies. Did they do a placebo-controlled safety study with an inert placebo, like saline? And you looked, you tried to even find one, right? Yeah. Did you find one?
No. I mean, there's essentially the HPV vaccine supposed Gardasil has a tiny group of, I want to say 300 and something individuals. And it's not even saline, it's carrier solution.
Right.
We don't need to get in the weeds on that. But
every other vaccine.
Everything. And that's not – and by the way, it's not a childhood vaccine. So you can honestly – for anyone out there, you can say not a single vaccine on the childhood schedule has been through, although I think HPV is about to be added in, or is in certain states. But
And I discovered that way back when I first started looking at vaccines. I did the same thing. I looked for – I look through other packages. I'm like, well, where's the placebo group?
Yeah.
You know, where's the, you know, that's just so scientifically, you know, boggles my mind that they even do that. And so you guys essentially challenged Department of Health and Human Services to show you, you know, how can you justify, you know, these safety studies without any placebo. And, and you know, they, you know, wrote you guys back and you guys wrote them back again. And I mean, give us a short version of, did they ever actually give any sort of, you know, cohesive answer to that inquiry?
Well, I mean, if anyone can read exactly how they responded. And we've put it into a paperback book now, so you can get all three letters in a book. It's kind of fun. Like, you know, it's something I can actually sign for people that want me to sign something.
Is that on the ICANN Decide?
Yeah, but if you go to ICANNdecide.org, you can download those. And really, the internet, I mean, doing it online is the best way, because you can read, and at the bottom of every page are the citations.
You can
click on the citations. Right. You can click on their citations. So they came back with, you know, the most thorough document I think that's ever been written from our health department explaining their science on safety. They cited a lot of studies. We spent almost a year reading every single piece of document that they were claiming proved that vaccines are safe. And we weren't going to just rush into that. And so there was a whole – it was funny because, you know, while I'm doing the high wire, I was seeing people comment from the other side saying, Del, no one knows that HHS has responded. I don't know how that got leaked out. We didn't tell anybody. You know, he's not responding. They're not responding. You know, HHS won. They don't. And the truth was, we didn't know. I mean, we were genuinely asking what we thought are the important questions as consumer advocates of a product injected into our babies. If the studies were there, we just wanted to see them. And so we were reading all of those studies. And then we finally responded with, I think it's going to ultimately be – it will be the most thorough document about vaccine safety ever written. It's 88 pages long. Mm-hmm. And we go through and comb through how this is a fraud, like how it's really – it's smoke and mirrors that they don't have it. They don't have placebo studies. They have no way to say that vaccines are safe. And that's going to be the demise of this science.
Hopefully,
I don't see how it's not. I mean – or we're imprisoned. You know what I mean? Yeah. Then we're a prison colony. Yeah. You know what I mean? And yeah. then I don't know.
Yeah.
And how long does that last? Yeah. You know.
I think you know, it seems like most of your public, you know, week by week time is spent doing the high wire now.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of curious if you could kind of walk us through. I mean, kind of what is that like, you know, from developing the ideas and then, you know, doing the writing and then, you know, prep and, you know, filming yeah. it and just kind of, I don't know, walk us through that. And who is Pat in charge of that, did you say? Or who kind of runs that?
It bounces around a lot simply because there's been a lot of change going on, you know, in California. I'm, you know, relocating. I've moved my family to Texas, something mm-hmm. that I'm just now going to start talking about just yeah. because, you know, I am still here for the fight in California and I love yeah. it here in California. But I travel so much that I feel like my family is in danger. You know, there's too many stories where, you know, someone's, you know, child breaks an arm. They end up in a hospital in California, Los mm-hmm. Angeles.
Yeah.
And then they want to give a DTaP vaccine for a broken arm. God yeah. knows why. And then you're into a discussion. And next thing I know, they're calling me and saying they're calling Child Protective Services. Of course, I get involved with lawyers. I get lawyers for people. And sometimes yeah. you know, I can't handle it all. There's just too many of these calls yeah. coming in. Yeah. And frankly, I can't ever have that be a call about my own child because I know I'm already pushing, you know, the envelope of the safety of my family.
Yeah.
But I've got to at least do what's necessary where I can see an actual danger or possible outcome that I wouldn't accept. And so yeah. for those reasons. So anyway, back to the point. There's a lot of moving around. But yeah, Patrick is essentially the director of the High Wire. Jen Sherry's come in to executive produce. Mm-hmm. And she really helped Patrick and Kat. And the High Wire started in UBN Studios because I came in to do a podcast with somebody else. And UBN Studios has daily, all day long podcasts. It's this great studio for people that want to start podcasting. And I went in as a guest, and afterwards, the Tony Smart, I think this is his name, Tony Sweet, who runs UBN, grabbed me and said, "You'd be great on your own show." And I said, "Wow, yeah, I never really thought about that." And he says, "Why don't you pick
tell
a time?"
Us the truth. had you really never thought you know, about
finally,
that?
Finally, someone's right, giving me right. my own show.
He's like, finally, somebody recognized me.
Let's just say this: it didn't take long to really say, "Yeah, like, I think I'll try that."
He's like, "Del, you should sold. Yes,
I'll try
yes,
that.
I'm on it." I thought you'd never ask.
Yeah, and so
when
I think
do
within
I start?
Like 2 weeks, we were in this little studio and attempting our first
ready.
Show.
You were ready.
What's really funny, though, is that you know my parents were – my mom was an actress. My dad was a writer before my dad became a minister. And I even say I grew up in a church, but my dad really was just using it to run a theater. But my parents were really improvisational. You know, my dad would write his talk at 4 in the morning on Sunday morning. And I was like, why don't you write it on Wednesday, you know? And he would say, I would if I could, but that's not when I know when it comes to me.
Yeah.
And my mom, same thing. I mean, and it was really stressful. I was the yeah. oldest of three kids. And so it would be my mom, you know, really eccentric and outrageous, but saying, you know, we don't have any special music today, so I need you to do a trio. We're going to sing this song. And it'd be like 1 hour to get ready.
Yeah.
And then go. And there was a big audience. My dad had like, you know, two or three services of 500 people apiece. So it wasn't a small deal. And the stress.
I don't
of that,
work well like that.
Yeah. Just it really, and it really yeah. created an allergy towards.
Yeah.
improvisation. So as an actor, I never took an improv class. Mm. I never wanted to be improvisational. In fact, and my wife, when I met her, she was the lead singer of a band. I ended up playing in her band and touring with her for a while. But I would rehearse more than anybody.
Yeah.
Like I had to have it so locked down because I didn't want any surprises. It was really, really important. Yeah. So I was sort of the opposite of my parents until the vax thing, until the Q&As, and I'd be asking questions and that came naturally. And then Wave asked me to speak and I just got up and it sort of came to me.
But you already do you've done your work, though.
I've done
That's
my
the
work.
Difference.
Yeah.
Like, you have the belief system, you have the background. So for you to just, even though you're talking off the cuff, you're already researched, essentially. Like, you're already prepared. Yeah. Like, it's not like somebody's asking you to go give a 30-minute speech on apples, and you're like, I don't...
True.
You know, like, so what's interesting is that you probably don't even realize the level of, like, work you'd already done to be able to be that in the moment. You know, because as you're describing, this is very much like me, and even as a singer, the same thing. I don't like being caught off guard, and I like to prepare for everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have those dreams about being on stage, and I don't know the song, and looking
at me.
I didn't have my costume. I don't know the dance routines, and I don't know the song, but everybody's looking, and I have to like fake it the whole way through, and how uncomfortable that makes me. And that's never happened to me in real life, but clearly that's something that concerns me, and it's probably why I work so hard on making sure I'm prepared, because I hate being blindsided or caught off guard. But what's interesting is sometimes we do the work without realizing we've done all that work, and it's what's made you safe enough to be able to come out and just be like, yeah, I'll do it. But you've done so much already that's layered you, that's gotten you to that point.
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. And you know, I kind of think in many ways I was supposed to be a minister. My dad, you know, you grow up in a family like that, and I'm the oldest, and I'm supposed to take over dad's church. And that wasn't what I was called to do. I always felt like I wanted to help evolve society and be a positive influence in the world. But I also wanted media. I wanted a larger platform than just standing in a room or something like that. But there is the thing that I think is, yes, the information's there. And I remember my dad always sort of complaining as a minister, like, how do you keep saying the same thing over and over again and keep it interesting? And I think that I have that thought now with what I'm doing. I mean, how many times can I lay out, you know, the information? And in fact, there was for a long time, I didn't even mention the 1986 Act until someone who I really thought had all the information didn't even know that part of it. I was like, you don't even know about that. I mean, I'm shocked at people I'm talking to sometimes that whether we would recognize them publicly or have spoken out on an issue, had no idea that they had no liabilities. So you realize you kind of have to keep hitting it over and over again. But the part of it that is different is that I don't know how to make, you know, I can't write a different talk every time, and I don't know what that would be. But there's a real space, especially in the rallies when I don't have a PowerPoint or something, where I know what I'll think about what I want to say, but I always go through the same process, which is right before I'm going to speak, I absolutely just clear my mind. And I really just try to think, you know, for me, it's a spiritual experience of saying, God, give this audience what they want to hear. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, like what message am I supposed to be?
Yeah. To be honest, I think, you know, just last week I was in Sacramento. A lot of people came up and said, oh, that was your best talk ever. And I don't even know what I said. Mm-hmm. Like I really, and it had, that's where I think, and there's times where I'm very calculated. And I'm good at that too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that feels good. But I've noticed that if I really don't know what I said, that those are kind of special moments.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go back.
That's passion-based, right? That's when the passion is just moving through you. And you're just, it doesn't have to be calculated because everything you're saying is genuine and it's coming from.
Yeah. When you're, I don't know, either whether it's a rally or going through the high wire and all the prep and the show, is there a certain part of that that you enjoy the most that you're just like, I don't know, whether it's the preparation or the delivery or the research ahead of time? Or
So I would say that the thing about the high wire that – and a unique person that could really say this because it's hard to talk about yourself. I mean this is – you know, but the truth is if Jen Sherry –
I'm not asking what you're good at.
No,
I'm asking what do you enjoy the most?
So like, what I would say is for – you know, Jen Sherry and I come from the same producing background from, you know, the doctors. She's now my executive producer, and she'll say – and she came in and really – what I was going to say is it started with Patrick, and Patrick learned how to make TV making the High Wire. I mean, we won this thing in a closet basically with a camera in it, And Kat would, I'd think of props the last minute. She'd whip up some props, and then we still all kind of long and look back at how rough and raw. There was a beauty to the original, you know, the High Wire when we first started, because it was just winging it, and we had like really no glitz or glam. And there was something that I think there's a little bit that's lost of that, you know, now that we have a little more production value. But what Jen, I think, would say, and she tells people that come in, and when we've had people come into studio to watch it, if you see my script, it's not like any script you'll ever really see in TV. And I don't use – I mean, it's sort of what I saw my dad do. My dad would just have like – he'd have like bullet points. Yeah. Like, how does this tell you anything?
It's an outline.
And mostly it's just winging it. And I really do – we came from – in Dr. Phil and the Doctors, that's a pre-taped show. So as much as there's anxiety and tension around running the show, you always knew any mistakes you could fix
right,
it.
We could fix it
in editing. Live TV is something I never produced. You know, none of us have. And those shows are so much fun because it's so dangerous. I mean, it really – you know, I think about one wrong slip up. If I put a set of words together the wrong way, or I make a misstatement, the trolls or the people that are against us are going to grab it. It's out there. There's no getting it back, you know. And knowing that when you jump into the High Wire every morning and on Thursdays. So how does it work? We finish the show on Thursday. Friday, none of us can think straight, so we will talk about what we think we're going to talk about next week. By Monday, we're throwing ideas on the table. Usually by Tuesday, there's so much media changing that all the ideas on Monday made no sense.
They're outdated.
And so really the show is kind of all put together.
On Wednesday.
Really hard Wednesday. A lot of people putting in a lot of late hours.
Yeah.
They're really good at getting me out of there. We run through, I was just there today, you know, sort of mapping out where we think the videos and things are going to go. And then usually I'll wake up at like 5 a.m, like my dad did, with some brand new inspiration and go in and
like, let's do this
throw out half the work that the team just did and said, now I know how this has got to go.
They love that.
And so they're winging it down to the last minute. And I always say, it doesn't matter how much we tried to prepare, that 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, you know, are we going to pull this off today? And I think that that's some of the fun of the show. I think you can sense that. Some of the times we pre-tape the shows and those have a different feel too. But, you know, it's live, it's real. And I don't think people think about, we don't have commercial breaks. Like even on a live show, I mean,
that's true.
You get, you know, 3 minutes to regroup and prepare for the next
fix your hair.
We don't even have that. You know, we're literally, it's an hour. It's been coming out on average 90 minutes of just absolutely hair on fire.
But Del's lucky because his hair doesn't.
It looks
have
so
a problem.
Crazy.
No,
it just like you just accept
like
it
already. It's doing its thing and it works. Like you don't have to mess with it. I feel like I'd be messing with my hair like the whole time. I just can't.
Yeah.
Girl,
I know. I did like we think like podcasting for an hour and a half. All we have to do is talk. You know, we can't
and
imagine
time,
having video going on.
Most of the time, I'm in like yoga pants and like we've got like our snacks. My hair is in a pony. I know.
Del was coming.
Del got the special treatment today. Whenever we have special guests, they get the special treatment.
Well, that's really cool. So people can tune into the High Wire every single Thursday.
Every Thursday, the High Wire is going to be there.
Or they can watch it later. They can watch it later if they want, but they can also watch it live and on your Facebook page. There's just a High Wire Facebook.
What's that? Is that 10, right? Is
it's
it 10 or 11?
11 a.m. Pacific time.
11 a.m. Pacific time.
10's pre-show.
Right.
10's pre-show.
Everybody get excited.
Depending on where you live, 10, you know, mountain time, I guess.
And then people can also go to icandecide.org and support you guys there. So you guys are – ICANN is a nonprofit.
That's correct.
So and people can donate
and
support.
And, you know, we're –
Well, let's talk about what he needs from the public too. Let's not forget that because that's kind of –
Yeah, so your initial question,
Initial – coming back – we'll finish with that. Like coming back to for your – this nonprofit. And for the work that you're doing and the vision that you have for it in this next year, in the next 2 years, the next 3 years, what you want to accomplish, the mission that you have. What, I mean, everybody says, oh, yeah, you can donate and here's the website. But like, more, including that, And including that, what do you really want from people? What do you want people to know? What do you want people to do? What do you need from people? What do people need to understand about this vision and how they can be a part of what you see to make that vision go from where it is now to where you want it to be? Like, how can these people listening that are obviously very passionate about this movement and passionate about you and want to help you, what can they do? Like, can you map it out exactly what you would want and what you need to make this dream a reality for you, for what you see?
It's a complicated answer because, first of all, I've already said that I'm not here to lead anybody to do anything. So to say that I have some vision that you need to jump on board and be a part of.
But you inspire people to do it.
I understand. I get that I inspire people and I know that they want to do something.
Or they want to support you. We're all frustrated.
Yes. We all get frustrated about what is it I'm supposed to do. And I don't know if I have a vision for the future. I mean, I don't know that I do. I think that, you know, to be totally honest, from the moment I got involved with Baxt, something spectacular happened. And it's hard to talk about it because, I mean, I do have a spiritual life. It really guides what I do. And there's a humility that is really important. I don't just mean that, but, you know, something that I don't talk about a lot and maybe gives us some sort of insight into this question. But early on with Vaxxed, there were a couple times where I think I had the first ever panic attack I've ever had. Not natural to me. I'm a pretty laid back person in life, I don't think things too seriously where I get myself upset. But there was, you know, one particular time I had just landed. The media was going crazy. We'd been kicked out of Tribeca. We were everywhere. I saw my name everywhere. And people warning me, you should be afraid for your life. And my God, are you protecting yourself? Like all of those things, which is always a constant. And I appreciate that people think like that. But I remember one time I was driving, I just left LAX, and just this cold black fluid just felt like it started at the top of my head and went to my feet. And I was terrified. I had to pull over. Like I couldn't breathe. I was really terrified. And I had to like come to grips with like, what am I terrified of? Like, what is going on? It was a really unnatural feeling for me. And I just remember in that moment, I sort of naturally talked myself out of this panic by saying, Del, you're just a filmmaker. All you did was you put a camera on a tripod. You put people in front of that tripod that had beliefs and science and things they want to talk about. They spoke their truth, not yours, and you edited that into a film, and you're good at that. That's what you do. The rest of this, all this hype, all the articles, the, you know, you're saving the world, you're ruining the world, all of those things are not you. That's something that's in something that's what the world is making of it. It's or maybe it's what your destiny is, but none of that you have control over. All you can do is continue to just take one step in front of the other, turn on cameras, tell the truth as you find it, put people in front of those cameras, and just keep trying to be a vessel for what's happening there. And it's, you know, and I was just talking to somebody today about this. It happened one or two more times, but then I started catching what was going on. It was much earlier. It was usually a week or two beforehand that I was putting myself in that position. And I looked at it like I became fascinated by the way I looked. I looked at the Bible in a different way. And I got really fascinated by the story of Jesus in the desert, you know, 40 days in the desert. And, you know, Satan is saying, you know, turn that stone into bread, you can eat, or, you know, you can make water, why you start, you know, and why don't you use this ability for something? And I saw the story differently in how my experience was, which was I started realizing that it was starting, the panic was starting weeks earlier, coming from a place where I would say something like, I need to do more. I should have made another phone call today. Or, you know, I've got to get to this rally, or, the, you know, and packing my schedule, you know, and more, and I need to do this. And if I don't do it, who's going to do it? And it really became very, you know, as much as it sort of had an altruism, I suppose, to it,
there's
it really
pressure.
Is very, but it's very ego-centered. Mm-hmm. It became about me and I and what I'm doing. And every time I'd have that panic moment, I realized I was all on an island all by myself.
Yeah.
And I can't do it all. And there's no way, and I'm smart enough. And I had to remind myself of something that I had said to Andy and Polly when there was a couple times where things really went wrong. Some of the information had gotten leaked out, or we looked like we'd been hacked, and Andy would get really upset, and it was some scary moments. And I remember saying to them, and it hit me that, and I said to Andy and Polly this one time, and I really think it's something that we all have to embrace, which is, I said, we will never outsmart the ad agencies and the think tanks that pharma has funded. We will never have the money to outspend the media campaigns that they have.
Right.
We're never going to buy all the politicians that they can buy. And so personally, and if, you know, I'm not putting my spiritual perspective, but I said to Andy and Polly, here's what I think. Either God is with us or we are effed. And I use the real word, and that may be unsanctimonious, but that's what I really believe. This thing is bigger than all of us, and there is something spectacular taking place. And if there is a vision, it's bigger than me. And all I'm trying to do is be as pure and clear a vessel that keeps my own ego and desires out of the way. I have an ego. I'm not trying to say, you know, I'm somehow some evolved person, but I try to be as honest with myself and as clear with myself and as clear with the people and as transparent and honest as I can be so that the truth has a way of winning this through us. I'm trying to be an example for what I want people to – I want them to experience the life that I have. I'm not trying to lead you. I'm telling you, I'm really, really lucky. I really am grateful for this life that I'm living right now. And I've read books. I've read The Secret. I've read these things when people like me tell you how you're supposed to live your life, and here's the answer. And none of it makes sense till you find your way there. But I believe we all have a purpose. I believe that we've all, for one reason or another, made some choice to be here at maybe the most critical and important time for this species and for this planet. And we've got to stop whining about it. We cannot be afraid because we are needed. By whatever, whether it's a collective unconscious, whether it's God, I don't care what you call it, something is bringing us all together. And I need people to listen to their own personal guidance. You have a place in this. You are here for a reason. I do not know what that is. I do not know what player you are, what, you know, part of the team you're on. All I know is I believe, because I wasn't listening, I was distracting myself with my own personal agenda, my 18-year-old dream of what I was supposed to be. When I got out of the way and just let things flow and started taking the steps and thinking something else is guiding me, let me take that step forward, it will make sense. I think if we all do that, there's nothing that stops us. Pharma's calculated. The brain is calculated. These people, there is money, there is egos. It's all the problems of the world are in this, but they can't be human the way we can. They can't be moved the way we can. And they are certainly not being guided by the beauty of humanity. Mm-hmm. And if we all are, that connection, if we stay connected, I think that every prophet of every religion has said that in that space, you prevail. Mm-hmm. My confidence is there because I've seen the miracles that bring us to this moment. We shouldn't be here. This has only been 3 years since Vax came out. Not that Vax did it all, but this movement has changed. This thing has changed. Mm-hmm. You know, Bob, you're a miracle, man. I mean, a doctor that took the risks that you have in this state, standing in it, you're following that. Melissa, you're following, you know, what you need to do. This podcast is awesome. More and more podcasts are coming out. More and more people speaking the truth. People telling the stories of their children. Talk to everybody. Talk to your friends. You cannot keep this to yourself any longer.
Yeah.
They are running out of time. They know the science is falling apart on them as we speak. The Abes and the Gutchas and the, you know, Zeben Yaos and, you know, Chris Shaws and Exley's, all of these great, great scientists, UC Davis, ASU, universities basically proving what Andy said was right. We have a gut connection with autism, all of these things. You cannot stop this train. It's on our side.
Right. Yes.
But we've got to announce it. Because if all of this happens in a forest and no one is there to hear it, that will be our demise.
Yeah, and I think that's our passion, is just simply that conversation with people and encouraging everyone to
not
have that
silent
conversation. Yeah. Your neighbors, your families, your friends, you cannot stay silent anymore. Mm-hmm. And nothing's more powerful than that humanity.
Yeah.
And you're right, pharma doesn't have that. And so, that's why we will win this eventually.
Well, on that note.
Yeah, thanks. Delta, thank you. That was, that was very, very deep and inspiring and personal. I remind me to talk in other episodes about some of my own kind of fears and panic attacks. And I was kind of thinking through some of the same things you were saying. And it can really get you if you let it. And if instead you just embrace your... You're just a vessel in this fight, and you're surrounded by people who love you and support you, and you support in turn.
Yeah.
That's where all the difference is made. And so, well, thank you guys for tuning into these, very deep, but hopefully very fascinating discussion.
Poignant.
And, deeper look into Del Bigtree and who he is and why he is. And the work you do, and thanks for tuning in, you guys, and we'll see you next time.
And thank you, Del, for coming down to the studio and having to do that amongst everything else that you're doing, and being willing to open up without knowing these questions in advance, and being willing to just go with it and take us on a journey. We could have done this for 18 more episodes. we had to cap it. Unfortunately, because I could keep going. It's so interesting. Yeah. There's so much there and so much to discuss. And we'll keep having these conversations as well.
All right. Well, see you guys next time on the Vaccine Conversation.
Information in this podcast is for entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as medical advice. Always consult your healthcare professional for information on vaccines and infectious diseases.